Our second presenter is S.T. Karnick, Samuel Karnick, Sam to his friends. He is Director of Publications and Research Fellow for the Heartland Institute. Previously, he served as Director of Publications for the Hudson Institute, where he was co-founder and editor-in-chief of its magazine, American Outlook. A pioneer in modern right-of-center criticism of popular culture, Mr. Karnick has written several hundred articles which have appeared in publications and websites as various as USA Today, National Review, The American Spectator, The Weekly Standard, The National Interest, Christianity Today, and many others, as well as for radio, television, and podcasts. For 12 years, he served as editor of the American Culture website. It is good to have someone with this perspective and expertise in our company.
Thank you, Dr. Nash. I just thought for sure that when you said known as Sam to his friends, that you were going to add, of whom I'm sure there are many.
I think so.
From an old movie. Well, whatever conservatism may be, it has increasingly banished from the nation's culture. It's been lost in the wilderness since the 1920s. Well, since the early years of the 20th century, the U.S. government has consistently undermined the financial stability and market discipline, which is the responsiveness to customer desires and economic efficiency, of critical cultural industries. I think this is something that we on the right have intuited but not been sufficiently aware of. So I'm going to outline some of those areas in which the government has made incursions into the culture in regard to radio and TV, the movies, pulp magazines, libel law, direct government spending on the arts, education, and the welfare state. And I'll do it as fast as I can. As we discuss culture, it's important to keep in mind how cultural products affect people and can make or break social consensus. The key concept here is normalization. It's the cultural equivalent of what psychologists call grooming, and I won't go too deep into that. You can look it up later if you like. But basically, it's accomplished through the cultural products. They draw connections between actions and consequences. Somebody does something, something happens, then something happens after that. Well, that sets in people's minds the ideas that maybe some of these things are connected. So, and they also associate particular actions and attitudes with attractive or unattractive people. People of different ethnic groups, male or female. That's how they send these messages to the society, and that's how they change minds. So culture really does have a profound effect on the mentality of a people. It's interesting, the Hollywood Reporter was writing about the rising acceptance of homosexuality, and they quoted the great thinker, Vice President Joseph Biden, and he said, I think Will and Grace, now I don't know if you know what that is, but that was a TV show in which one of the characters, or a couple of the characters, were homosexuals. It was very bold, I guess. But he said, I think Will and Grace did more to educate the American public more than almost anything anybody has done so far. People fear that which is different. Now they're beginning to understand. I guess we are. That's what's called normalization. And it works across the board throughout the culture. Biden's comments, though, what they do show is that politicians and other policymakers are well aware of the power of culture. And that in itself explains why the government has done so much to control the culture since the very first years of the progressive era. It's important to note that until at least the 1970s, the American culture was by no means monolithic. Before World War II, movies, radio, popular fiction, especially pulp fiction, sports and other areas of the culture, they presented a great variety of subject matter and character types, and they largely conveyed traditional values. They were responding to the desires of their audience. So what happened? Well, in the teens and 20s of the 20th century, technological change began making it possible for communications companies to reach vast audiences very quickly. And the development of the art of public relations in the 1920s made it possible for anybody with a printing press or a radio program to exert a great new influence over public opinion. For the next few decades, governments stepped in to break up these cultural redoubts. We're not surprised, I hope. We'll start with the first big threat to politicians' power, which was radio. In the 1920s, the earliest years of the new medium, the federal government claimed the authority to grant licenses to broadcast on radio and to assign the frequencies and power levels of individual stations. Oh, they had their reasons, and we all know those. But the government's policies concentrated power in the hands of a few politically influential companies. The Federal Radio Commission, for example, quickly began eliminating radio stations, which reduces competition, of course. With the first denials of licenses were being based explicitly on their programming content, which was supposed to be unconstitutional. One of the great examples is KGEF in Los Angeles, California. It was a Christian radio station that came under political attack in L.A. for exposing widespread corruption among Los Angeles politicians. So this series of actions created a government-sanctioned oligopoly that concentrated power in just a few large corporations. And those corporations became the major TV networks after World War II. This oligopoly benefited from government policies. The FCC used its power over licenses and spectrum, and it kept fledgling networks such as Dumont and Overmeyer from gaining audience share in the early 1950s, again, reducing competition. FCC rule changes, in fact, they drove Dumont out of business, and Dumont was the most innovative TV network, and it was a pioneer in programming for minority audiences. The government drove it out of business. Well, it's obvious that the remaining networks would be very careful not to wander into the government's crosshairs. So the federal government's only serious action to add competition was to create a rival non-commercial network called PBS in the 1960s, which quickly became a source of programming for an upscale audience and did nothing to increase competition. Real competition only came around the 1980s when you had the rise of cable television, which was a technological change, and it happened to occur during a period when Ronald Reagan was president, and he wasn't so regulation happy as previous administrations. So that made the Fox network possible, but you know what happened? The great majority of those most popular stations now, most popular channels, they're still owned by the same few large corporations. So ESPN is a perfect example of this. It doesn't show a lot of response to market discipline because ESPN owns, Disney owns ESPN, and there are several ESPN stations, and Disney also owns ABC, and it owns a billion other channels. So Disney can afford to do what they want, and we'll see this in a minute in another realm. So the federal government had a similar effect on the movie industry. In the 10s and 20s and 30s, the movies were relatively, they're certainly decent compared to today. And back then, the studios were very concerned about states possibly censoring them. So what they did was they got together and they formed what was called the Hollywood Production Code, which was written up in 1934, but it was really adhered to in large part before that as well. So all of this was very voluntary, beneficial to the industry, and the Hollywood studios enjoyed a prestige and an audience appeal that few areas of U.S. popular culture have ever achieved. I mean, just compare them to the way audiences feel about the movies now. So that very cultural power led directly to a federal government crusade to break up the motion picture industry in 1948. After 10 years of threats and negotiations, the federal government forced the movie studios to sell off their theaters and film distribution companies that supplied them. So the government said, well, your vertical integration violates the Sherman Antitrust Act, which was one of the signature laws that launched the progressive era. So the federal government killed the Hollywood studio system. Well, what that led to ultimately is the industry became what it is today. Corporate subsidiaries dependent on revenue from foreign countries, releasing occasional blockbusters that finance a steady stream of money losers that don't have to respond to market forces. So the movie industry, that's why you get all these weird films that just don't make any sense. Why would somebody make this? Well, because they can't. It doesn't matter. And so what you have there is it's now got an overwhelming leftist bias with an insular, clannish in-crowd protected from market discipline. And that's Michael Medved, is a film critic who's done a great job of documenting that. The U.S. government also had a central role in the disappearance of the pulp magazines, which was a dominant form of storytelling between the two world wars. Although printed on cheap paper with lurid covers and recounting sensationalist depictions of crime, horror, action, or romance, Pulp Fiction strongly conveyed a respect for personal responsibility, hard work, self-control, and bourgeois values. Now, they often did this in The Breach, but heroes such as The Shadow, Zorro, Doc Savage, and Conan the Barbarian exemplified these values, and these stories provided exciting narratives for lower-income people at bargain prices. And they helped to develop the morality and values of the group that would come to be known as the Greatest Generation. Well, what happened? During World War II, the federal government commandeered the cheap paper that the pulps were used for, and that killed off the pulps. And they were a model of consumer satisfaction, salutary product, and market discipline, and they were gone in a flash. Another government action that had a profound effect on the nation's culture was the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in New York Times Company versus Sullivan in 1964. The court ruled that a public figure claiming to have been libeled must prove malice on the part of the defendant. Needless to say, that's pretty hard to do. And that standard overthrew centuries of common law, and it has emboldened news outlets to vulgarize their activities into a web of speculation and outright lies. You've heard it called fake news, and this is the source of it. And it's a government action, again, that caused this. And then the government has also given billions and billions and billions of dollars to favored cultural organizations. The government transparency watchdog opened the books, reports that the National Foundation on the Arts and Humanities gave out $446 million to cultural organizations in 2016. In 2018, now get this, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Smithsonian Institution, Institute of Museum and Library Services, the National Gallery of Art, U.S. Department of Education Arts Programs, Kennedy Center, U.S. Commission of Fine Arts, and the nation's military bands together received $2.2 billion. And you've probably not even heard of what a lot of those organizations are. Well, that's where your money's going. So, and you've heard all the horror stories about government-financed artworks, like the photos of Andre Serrano and Robert Mapplethorpe. Look them up if you want. I can't bear to describe them. The more important point is that obviously none of this taxpayer money is going to organizations and activities that are dedicated to smaller government. In fact, in 1997, the Heritage Foundation referred to the National Endowment for the Arts as, quote, welfare for cultural elitists. I think that says it all. Further, there's plenty more examples. We can talk about Google, and maybe we'll do this during the Q&A, because why is Google so strong, and why is everybody so worried about Google? The government did that. The most powerful force that removed conservatism from its proper place in the culture, however, was the nation's system of government schools. In the wake of 1960s Supreme Court decisions that falsely characterized religious expression in public schools as an unconstitutional establishment of religion, government schools have become a de facto program of forced indoctrination in progressive thought. Obviously, there's little to no market discipline in public schools, in government schools. So freed from the need to please their customers, the nation's schools in the past 60 years have promulgated philosophical and moral relativism. None of this will be new to you, but it's good to bear in mind. They've deployed bizarre pedagogical methods that don't provide students with skills and knowledge, and that also prevent parents from assisting their children's learning. Because as they change the pedagogical methods, the parents don't know what the heck they're teaching, and so they can't help their kids. And they've also implemented social emotional training, which is to inculcate children with attitudes the government prefers them to have. And they've taught a tendentious view of American history that characterizes our country as a fundamentally corrupt place. I think, again, we all know that, but this is what our government has been spending our taxpayer money on, and that they've insisted that we do. Our government schools have leave large numbers of students unequipped for success in the world and diminish their sense of personal responsibility. In a democracy or a democratic republic, dependency can serve the interests of the state. By increasing the population of individuals who find it difficult or unappealing to take care of themselves and hence have a powerful incentive to vote themselves access to other people's money. In addition, the immense infusion of government money into higher education during recent decades, which you heard alluded to this morning, that's removed market discipline from that world almost entirely. So the current system amounts to indoctrination in luxurious cocoon free of challenges to the reigning doctrine of identity politics and anti-Americanism. So we add to all this the effects of the welfare state, which separates fathers from their children and removes the parental example of personal responsibility and self-reliance. In all these ways and more, government policy has perverted the nation's culture. Yet somehow, despite all of these obstacles, Americans continue to try to create positive cultural change, and consumers try to send good signals to the culture industries. So there are some positive things to build on. In network TV in recent years, depictions of bad behavior have often been used to make traditional moral points. For example, the crimes depicted on TV cop shows are they're certainly more perverse than ever, more sensationalistic than ever. They make Pulp Fictions look pretty simple. But the narratives often express a positive view of conventional morals, if only by showing the disastrous consequences of immorality, lack of self-control, and the loss of social order. Remember what I said about normalization? It works the other way, too. When you connect some behaviors to bad outcomes, people figure it out. They learn from that. And so these programs commonly depict the trials and tribulations of various types of do-gooders thwarted by corrupt authority figures. So you'll have the good captain and the of the police, and his superiors are making him do, or her, do stupid things. We've all seen that. Comedies today, obviously they're raunchier than ever before, but they do indicate a serious longing for more order in the characters' lives, especially their romantic lives, and they commonly show the plight of people in a hyper-sexualized, sensation-seeking society. And CBS recently has done two shows that are based on biblical premises, one called Living Biblically and the other called God Friended Me, which is starting this year. Living Biblically was not a fabulous show, but it was better than most of what's going on out there. So the desire for change is there. Restoration of market discipline in the nation's culture industries could set us on a path toward regeneration. Cultural change can happen much more quickly than most people conceive to be possible. Remember the 1960s. So what can individuals do? Well, first of all, we all can be more attentive to the culture, and we can react to it. First of all, you can look at cultural objects with this in light, idea about what kinds of messages they're sending. And ones that are sending positive messages about personal responsibility, self-reliance, hard work, being a good neighbor, personal charity, faith in God, those are American ideas. Those are the American ideas. And those are what made this country what it is and can make it better. So what we can do is when you watch a movie, when you read a book, especially a book of fiction, if you ever do, when you read some poetry, when you listen to music, put a response on Amazon.com. You know, put a comment down there saying whether it was good or bad and why, and engage in this. It doesn't take long, and it's worth it. People really do listen to other people's opinions, and the more we do that, the more we create at least the foundations for a little bit more market discipline in those areas. But that's not going to get it done. That's not going to finish the process. What we really need is a sort of cultural fusionism in which we're going to take libertarian means to traditional ends. So we could build a better culture. It will foster the search for and popularization of a conservative identity. We have to do four things in the policy realm. One, replace government schools with non-government ones in every possible case through universal school choice in every state where we can get it, and eventually, and all government schools. Just don't have any schools run by the government. Two, reduce the deleterious effects of the welfare state by adding work requirements to all social welfare programs. We can start with that. Three, scale back and essentially zero out government support of higher education, especially at the federal level. And four, remove the countless government policies and regulations that reduce market discipline in the industries of culture. It's not too late to spark a renewed appreciation of time-tested moral and ethical standards and the nation's history and Judeo-Christian religious tradition. We conservatives and classical liberals and whatever else we're called, we have nothing to lose but our despair. Thank you.